Good morning. This is the KUNM Collins Show. I'm Elaine Baumgartel. Thanks for joining us this morning. Today, we're holding a live radio town hall with First District Representative Michelle Lujan Grisham. She's a Democrat. She was elected in 2012 in what was one of the closely watched races here. Her opponent, Republican Heather Wilson, had represented the district for 10 years. And we'd like to take your calls this morning. The number to call locally is 277-5866. You can also call toll-free 877-899-5866. You can email collinshow@kunm.org. You can also post your comments online at kunm.org. Good morning, Michelle. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Good morning, Elaine. I'm really excited to be here. I got a little hoarse voice, typical New Mexican. Yes, a little bit of allergy, a little bit of cold, a little bit of something.
I'm kind of the same, so you and I can be husky today.
I'm there.
So thanks so much for coming in this morning. I wanted to start off just by asking you to give us a little bit of a reflection on what your first couple of months in office have felt like for you. Talk a little bit about that.
You know, honestly, Elaine, the most common description, which is absolutely accurate, is drinking water from a fire hose.
We hear that a lot.
Yes, it is. There's no way to really describe the transition from the campaign to actually being on the job. And I think, and certainly I did, that you're so busy in a campaign that the transition's actually going to be easier. But it's not. But it's incredibly exciting. We're on three different committees, getting debate the budget, feeling like I'm really in a position to protect New Mexicans. Certainly going to need more time to do that effectively. But I'm really excited to be doing it.
So you are the first Latina to represent New Mexico in Congress. Let's hear a little bit about how that has felt for you.
Well, I'm really honored and proud. I'm part of the most diverse freshman class in the history of the Democratic class, which is incredible. I'm one of only two Hispanic women to be elected, another woman, Gloria Negrete McLeod, out of California. And that was also a large boost to the entire Hispanic caucus. And I will tell you, being one of only two Hispanic women elected, I was then elected to be the Hispanic Caucus Whip, which is a leadership position that most freshmen aren't going to be in a position to attain. But the voice of women, particularly as we talk about immigration reform and full implementation of health care, I think is vital and important, and I'm really honored to be in a position to do it.
That was one of the areas I wanted to go to with you, to talk about immigration reform and your role on the Hispanic Caucus. Immigration, a big issue. It's viewed a little bit differently in New Mexico than it is in other parts of the country. Your family has a very, very long history in New Mexico. I think it's 12 generations, is it?
We identify 12. We think it could be as many as 16. That's what we can prove, 12.
So talk to me about what perspective you bring from New Mexico to the debate on immigration in Washington, D.C. that you believe is unique and adds to that debate.
Easy. The value of having your family and the rich culture and diversity that brings and the benefits that brings to a particular community or state. And the longer that we delay immigration reform with 12 million people in the shadows, the longer that we create a nonsense of unity in our communities. And last night I was actually at a meeting, and a woman described her story to me. And she's got two dreamers brought here when they were toddlers. Her son was in college and was stopped and then deported. And they've been separated I can't remember whether it's been a year or 2 years. And the heartbreak for this mother. And he was in college and doing incredibly well. And, you know, this is somebody who wants to benefit this community and our society, who's done nothing wrong, didn't make the decision to come to this country on his own. Separating those families and being the country that creates that barrier, I think, is hugely problematic. And right now in Congress, we're waiting for the Senate bill. This is a real opportunity to bring revenue in, to bring people out of the shadows. Colorado's to finally have a system, and then to talk about what immigration looks like in totality in this country. So we're not just dealing with people who immigrated from Mexico, which I also think creates a whole level of discrimination that we have let hang in our society for far too long.
What about some of the opposition to immigration reform concerns about I think some of the perspective is that if folks who are in the country illegally are allowed a path to citizenship, perhaps even faster than folks who are trying to become citizens of the country, talk a little bit about how you see that playing in.
There's no question that that whatever we pass in Congress is going to have equity provisions because you can't
describe
just...
what you mean by that, equity
provisions.
Well,
it's got to be fair. So there, your point is really valid. There are people who broke no rules, who are in a process in this country to immigrate here legally, and all of a sudden 12 million people jump the line. And what naysayers and people who are very concerned both and have a legitimate position are saying, look, that's amnesty. Well, that is not what anybody's talking about in Congress, not Democrats and not Republicans. They're talking about tough pathways, which means there can't be so many barriers and hurdles that there's no pathway at all. But you're going to have to pay fines and back taxes. There's going to be have to a mechanism to do that. And it's going to take longer than just sort of an overnight magic wand that we identify 12 million people and you're done. They'll have to be dedicated to that process. And if there's been any commitment of any crime or nefarious activity, those individuals have no pathway to citizenship and will, in fact, we will continue our efforts to deport them back to Mexico.
Talk about any divisions that exist on the Hispanic caucus around immigration.
You know, we are unified. That is the important issue. The Hispanic caucus is uniquely determined on this issue. And I got to meet with the president within my first 3 weeks, which apparently is another thing you don't get to do as a freshman, which is very exciting. And the sense in that meeting for me as the brand new person on the immigration reform debate at that level is, look, we have waited far too long. This is the time to do it. The election, certainly in 2012, was about this is one of the country's priorities. You've got to do something about it. And while they were talking about strategy, I talked about the families who were affected in this state and the politics in this state and policymaking are held hostage in a state like New Mexico and states like Arizona and California while they wait. And the caucus made it clear that you have to have a pathway to citizenship, that we have to do something about family reunification, that we've got to do something about enforcing appropriate protection for American workers here now and competing for jobs, and a pathway for that to the continuation of work, particularly in ag. And that those principles have to be in any immigration bill that we pass, and it has to be comprehensive. So, for example, if we see a measure that's just border security, which, by the way, we've got more than $83 billion more money in border security today than ever before. So if we just did more border security, then you don't have the caucus, which means you probably don't have any of the minority caucuses on board in the House. It has to come together because we believe if it doesn't, it won't be meaningful, and all of it won't get passed, and it'll have huge fatal flaws.
Michelle Lujan Grisham represents the 1st District here in New Mexico in Congress in Washington, D.C. If you have a question for her on immigration or another topic, you can call locally here in Albuquerque, 277-5866. You can also call toll-free 877-899-5866. You can email your comments or questions to callinshow@kunm.org or post them online at kunm.org. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back with your calls and comments. This is the KUNM Call-In Show.
Join Blackout Theater Company at the VSA North 4th Theater for The Poe Project, Nearly This and Nothing More. This critically acclaimed play, based on the works of Edgar Allan Poe, promises to be a dark, suspenseful thriller. The play runs March 22nd through April 7th, Fridays and Saturdays at 8 p.m., Sundays at 2. For tickets and more info, visit blackouttheater.com. That's Blackout Theater with an R.E.com. A message from the tax-exempt Blackout Theater Company. UNM's Office of the Provost has announced the winners in the KUNM Radio Board election. Four candidates, Willis Duff, Mark Robert, John Brown, and Dixie Cole, received the most votes and will be seated at the Radio Board's May meeting. Bob Davis and Brian Neal received the next highest number of votes and will serve as alternate members of the board. KUNM wishes to thank the Office of the UNM Secretary, all of the candidates, and our contributing listeners for participating in the Radio Board election.
This is the KUNM Call-In Show. I'm Elaine Baumgartel, and we are joined this morning by Michelle Lujan Grisham. She is the first district representative in Congress for New Mexico. Thanks so much for coming in this morning.
Thanks, Elaine.
I want to switch to another hot topic right now, the issue of gun control legislation. President Obama was in Colorado yesterday. You know, some people have said he's capitalizing on public opinion about gun control in the wake of recent mass shootings. Talk about what you would like to see and the impact in New Mexico. We've had some mass shootings recently here in New Mexico.
This is a really, again, these are very critical issues, and this country's got an opportunity to take some real steps forward. I was actually very proud to hear the president, I think last week, say he's a bit embarrassed that we have not moved much quicker in the public safety debate about gun violence in this country in the wake of what happened in Connecticut. And I will tell you, Elaine, one of the things I did in Congress is I participated in a panel where those families and a community of victims came to talk to us about Sandy Hook. And I will tell you that that was probably the most difficult hearing to sit through in my entire life.
Did it change your perspective?
It is absolutely life-changing. Now, before the hearing, I said publicly that I think it's time that we really talk about an assault ban, a ban on assault weapons and high magazine cartridges. And I completely support all the Bill of Rights and the amendments. Second Amendment, I think, has got to be held to be a firm foundation of what our founding fathers intended for our individual rights. And I'm a sportsman. I fish. I don't hunt. But the reality is we're talking about a weapon with such power that the destruction and lives it took. And you need to think about both those things.
But isn't the idea of the Second Amendment, at least from what I understand, that individuals should have power that is perhaps equal to that of what their government has?
I mean, that was certainly when you were fighting the government. And then with the Civil War, our whole perspective about the government's role and our individual roles completely shifted. But the problem with the interpretation of the Second Amendment for individuals who are responsible gun owners is the sense that somehow now the government, by virtue of these laws, could actually take their guns away, and that this is an effort to minimize your individual freedom in that regard. So it doesn't really get to the debate about why you had a Second Amendment and how important that was to equalize individual rights equal to those of your government. But here we have some of the highest gun violence problems in the world that sent Sandy Hook something like 1,800 more incidents of gun violence. We're talking about suicides and mass shootings and copycat issues, and we are not getting them addressed at all. And I think that Congress has an obligation to start at the ceiling in terms of every idea from closing the gun show loophole to universal background checks to thinking about whether or not bans on certain kinds of classes of weapons whose only purpose is to kill or harm another human needs to be part of that debate, and potentially even talking about some of the underage violence video games that I think are there are now studies showing that all of that together is part of a culture shift in this country so that responsible gun owners get the protections and the support that they need and the training, and we're keeping those guns safe and locked up and they're not in the hands of individuals that they shouldn't be, and that we're taking a stand.
Let's go to the phones now. Meta in Albuquerque, good morning. You're on the air.
Yes, my call. I just wanted to thank so much the representative for her leadership on gun control. I'm very concerned about it kind of getting pushed off and watered down by the NRA. And I was so distressed to see that of our delegation, you're the only one who is really strongly 100% behind President Obama's plan. And that even though I admire and like Senators Udall and Heinrich, they have not come out so strongly. So what can we do to move this issue forward? And I'm just wanting to keep the momentum and not just be, you know, sort of under the avalanche of the way the NRA works and kind of slows things down. So what would you say we can do to support your point of view, Representative?
Oh, thank you very much. It's a huge uphill climb and a heavy lift. You know, if people would contact my office and go to the, you can find us readily on the website. I need individuals and your stories and petitions, because then I can show that what this district believes is that we've got to do something about gun violence. I think that they've waited so long in Congress that now, and I think they really do want to push it to the states. I'm sure you know that Connecticut now has passed state legislation, having the strongest gun violence legislation in the country, that here we weren't able to get that done. Although I want to give a shout out, our governor did say that she would sign a bill with universal background checks. And while I don't think that's enough, anything that gets us in the right steps, I'm in favor of. We'll also put on our website a list of coalitions that are beginning to form, and to get people to join those coalitions, because I don't think our voices are strong enough in the wake of not only the NRA, but a movement by individuals who feels or fears that the government, again, is going to take away individual freedoms, is not looking at this epidemic. This is a public health epidemic in this country.
Let's take another call. Ronald in Albuquerque, following up on our conversation about immigration.
Hello. Good morning. I'm curious to find out on this. You're talking about the dreamer who had been in the States from a toddler until he was in college and then got deported.
Uh-huh.
And then we were talking about the equity and the not a get-home-free, no-penalty path to citizenship. I'm still trying to figure out the equity between this guy who is now back in his country of birth with the better part of a U.S. college education compared to the kid who was born the same day whose mom didn't violate the law and has thus been raised in whatever it was they were trying to escape in the native country, whether it was Mexico or Saudi Arabia or wherever, saying, well, now, where's the fairness in the relative penalty for the son of the law-abiding mother, as opposed to this kid who's now back with a college education from the United States and should do extremely well in his local community with a college education, which is rare.
Well, fair enough. Although, you know, I don't know that he actually got to finish his college education, and we need more college educated. We need a workforce here, which is a major issue in this country. The issue about the individual who immigrated here legally and whose child then had legal status in this country, and I'm not sure if I understood about whether they may not have had access to a college education. They should have had access. What we have to do is solve all these problems so that you're creating an environment where we're not pitting one group of immigrants against another, and we're not pitting the folks who are here, all citizens here, who feel like they don't have pathways to get out of poverty, to go to college. And that's the problem, that we don't solve any of these issues. We just let them sit far too long and create then de facto or real discrimination issues. We should talk about access to college and what's going on now with college debt. And we should talk about why I didn't vote for the Ryan budget, which in fact would raise double interest rates on loans for kids going to college. I want as many individuals who want an American college-level education, who are planning then to provide and give back to this country and this community as we can get. That's the best way to stabilize our economy, to increase our per capita income, and to do something about this country's growing poverty.
Let's take a call from Brian in Albuquerque. Good morning, Brian. You're on the air.
Good morning, Congresswoman Lujan. My question is about the sequester. I'm an employee in the Office of the Federal Public Defender, and I'm one of the individuals in New Mexico who is facing a mandatory furlough and what amounts to a 10% pay cut. although I'm not facing a 10% cut in my workload. I'm calling with a two-part question. One, what does the future look like for federal workers in the short term? Namely, will these cuts that are caused by the sequester likely be restored in the 2014 budget? And two, and probably the broader question, as a public employee, I feel very much put upon. I feel like I'm a part of an assault on public workers being launched by particularly House Republicans, but people who look at us as freeloaders and you know, people with high-paying jobs and low responsibilities. And I'm wondering what, if anything, you and your colleagues in the Democratic Caucus can do to raise the level of discourse so that all public workers are viewed in the same way as, say, soldiers, sailors, and Marines, because we're all devoted to public service. For example, my colleagues in the federal court system are committed to public safety and law enforcement, and we're treated like, frankly, like dirt by these Republicans in Congress. And I'm wondering what, if anything, we can do to raise that level and to regain the luster and the respect that comes with public service.
Oh, I really thank you for that statement and your question, and I agree with you. I did public service in state government for 17 years and really worked hard as a cabinet secretary to provide the respect and support that those public employees deserve. And I think people just don't have any idea that while the salaries are fair, often sometimes too low, and today many of the benefits are really good, people have no idea that my staff in, say, protective services for adults who were at risk of being abused are working 80-hour weeks, have these incredible caseloads, and do not have the resources or the tools to really do their jobs adequately, and they carry those burdens home. Same is true in the public defender office, where the cases are just insurmountable, the amount of work that has to be done, and there's just not enough support to do it. So it takes somebody who's dedicating their lives, basically, to protecting other individuals. So let me tell you three things. One, I actually voted for legislation, and this is what's going on. This is why the sequester is still in place. Neither Republicans or Democrats in the Budget Control Act wanted the sequester, but they couldn't agree. I mean, just the divide between how to move forward, it's so deep and so severe. That was the only way to do anything, and they really thought that they could come to a deal, and as you know, they weren't able to do that. In a bill by the Republicans, They offered a fix so that, I mean, they offered a bill that would, you had to make a choice between potentially giving yourself a raise as a, because I'm a federal employee, or voting against that and voting against all federal employees and doing another cut. So, of course, I voted to protect federal employees and then immediately had to put out a press statement that said, if I somehow get a COLA or a raise or anything happens in that context, I will return that money to the U.S. Treasury. So we play these games where people are in these untenable boxes, so you never get a chance to talk about why public employees and why federal employees are so necessary, more than the military, air traffic controllers, public defenders, the folks who are doing veterans benefits, the people who are providing intakes at veterans hospitals. I mean, the protective services for children and for adults, it's unbelievable. So quickly, the third thing is this. The sequester, I think, I hope, I pray, gets resolved in 2014. We've prevented a government shutdown. We kept the sequester. I'm very unhappy about that and disappointed at Congress. But I think that we are going to get the substance work done that gives us enough time to start to close that divide on a much more balanced approach to a budget plan in 2014.
Michelle Lujan Grisham represents the 1st District here in New Mexico in Congress in Washington, D.C. And I have an email question from Katie. She writes, how can we average citizens get Congress to actually do anything right now? From here in Albuquerque, it looks like every effort in every direction is stymied by those wanting to stop the president's agenda. Is that accurate? Do petitions work? Do placing calls work? What she's asking, what do average citizens do?
Yeah, yes, it does work. So I just talked about the divide, and as a new person coming in, you know, you've got, I have great enthusiasm, I hope that shows, and optimism, and I've got so much that I want to do for this community. And you can do a lot as a congresswoman through the administration. We've got great ideas, I think, about making an impact in this community. Your voice does get heard. Is there still a situation in Congress where extremists in the Republican Party are holding hostage everything we do? Yes. But look,
that is also the power of the minority, right? That's expression of power of minority in this particular case.
It is. But look what's shifted.
Or the majority, depending on which house you're talking about.
In the last 2 years before I was elected, nothing got done. In this year, we've got the Violence Against Women's Act was reauthorized. That took Republican votes in the Senate, and it was women. And then the Republican women in the House and some of their male counterparts made sure that that legislation got through, which was, and they weren't going to vote for it because, of course, it was protecting LGBT women, which it absolutely should, and Native American women. And we're going to do something on comprehensive immigration. And look, there's a bipartisan group in both the Senate and the House. And I think that while I fear I will be disappointed in what comes out of Congress for gun safety, we will get something out and it'll be a stepping stone. I don't think it's going to be comprehensive. And we'll keep fighting until we get what we need. These are those little jewels that show me that we're getting closer than to dealing really with the budget. I have great optimism that the tide is turning.
We're taking your calls this morning on the KUNM Collins Show. The number locally here in Albuquerque is 277-5866. You can also call toll-free 877-899-5866. It's what we like to call a live radio town hall with First District Representative Michelle Lujan Grisham. She is a Democrat. She was elected in 2012. In one of the more closely watched races that year, her opponent, Republican Heather Wilson, represented the district for 10 years. Let's go to...
I have to correct you now. Heather Wilson did hold the seat, but she ran for the U.S. Senate seat and lost to Heinrich.
She represented the district for 10 years. And then she ran for Senate, and she was out. And Heinrich represented the—
Right, but my opponent was Janice Arnold Jones.
Oh, my God, you're totally right.
Yep.
Thank you for correcting
you're
me.
You're welcome.
What a dork. Sometimes I am. All right, let's go to—
Never.
I know, right? Let's go to Andres in Albuquerque. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hello, Michelle. How are you doing? Andres Valdez with Vecinos United. I hope you remember us.
Andres, always remember you and the great work that you do in our community. How are you this morning?
Oh, very, very good. Thank you. Michelle, we have been trying to meet with your office on three major issues, and we have not been scheduled, and we really need to. And the issues are land grants. We have been requesting from the federal government to negotiate with New Mexico and representatives of displaced land grant heirs to return millions of acres that the government has stolen. The other issue is police brutality. It is rampant in Albuquerque. It is rampant in New Mexico, and it's rampant in the United States. It's a big, big problem. And the question is, and we need solutions, what real human and civil rights do we have? And as we look at things, it appears as that we don't have very much, and that needs to be revisited. The other issue is large and huge. It's economic democracy. Our organization has a solid, solid solution that would transform the 1% versus the 99% ratio. It's a model of economic democracy that where the workers own everything. It's called the Mondragon economic system. And we really need to talk to you, being our state being one of the poorest states in the whole nation, or the poorest. This economic democracy model has 55 years of success. There's no way that it can not be something that needs to be looked at. If it's ignored, it's totally detrimental to our state. And so we really need to meet with you to discuss these issues with you. And also, we had asked your office if you could help us get this information, or we had been wanting to meet with President Obama about that, and we we were hoping that you might be able to also help us do that. But first of all, we really want to your support on these issues and see if you would advocate for us on these issues.
Well, clearly we should meet. Those are a lot of issues. I'm on the Agriculture Committee. I think that that's going to be an important committee for jurisdiction on land grant issues and water, alternative energy, support for our farmers, ranchers, and community and livestock. So, Andreas, I'll have somebody give you a call. I just happen to have your phone number right in my personal cell phone, so that's not going to be too hard. And we're open to every idea and strategy that a constituent in the district or the state has that improves the quality of life. So I appreciate your passion and the fact that you took a moment to call us, and I'll make sure that we get to you as soon as the radio show is over, maybe if my office is listening, even before.
So Representative Lujan Grisham, I want to follow up with you about Andres's question. The Department of Justice is investigating the Albuquerque Police Department and the department's use of force in the...
Excessive use.
Give me your reaction to this investigation. What would you like to see come out of it?
Well, I think it's important that we have independent, objective oversight. Now, as someone in state government, I'm going to give you both sides of that equation, who's had the Department of Justice coming in. That's a tough issue because you can have unintended consequences with your law enforcement. So I'll give you an example. You know, Bernalillo County Sheriff's Office, those deputies are doing incredible work, and there's a shadow.
You did serve on the Bernalillo County Commission.
And they're doing great work, and that shadow can be very negative in that context, and the new rules and requirements can be problematic. The fact that we've got a problem in this community, clearly, where we've got excessive use of force, if we don't find out what is at the root cause, and you can't tell our citizens that we really don't have a safety issue, the only way that you can do that, you cannot have an internal review. That just doesn't work. There's just not enough credibility. This is an opportunity to have experts from the outside take a look and once and for all settle for us what is going on in that department. And the resignation of the captain, I mean, I think there's just lots of unanswered questions in this community. And the sooner that we get those questions answered, then the sooner that we can move on and feel secure that we've got an operation in our police force that's just and fair and appropriate in this community.
APD Police Chief Ray Schultz has announced that he will step down. Let's take another call. David in Santa Fe. Good morning, David. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you. And yeah, before I ask my question, coincidentally, I have a federal civil rights lawsuit against APD right now for being arrested for videotaping them. And APD has finally admitted wrongdoing and wants to settle, but we are doing it in the court process. But what I called about is, and first of all, I want the public to hear me ask you to leave me on the phone for a five-second rebuttal after you respond so that the question can't be sidestepped, because it's been sidestepped by every politician I've ever asked on the radio so far, and that's been very many. I recently won in the Court of Appeals in New Mexico in the adoption matter of Kurt O. Elitch versus myself, David O. or David Olson in case 31451. I won that. Kennedy, Bustamante, and Wexler unanimously agreed that my children had been sold illegally by Judge M. Monica Zamora, who ironically is on the Court of Appeals right now. And the point is that this is human trafficking and this is child selling. It's unlawful adoptions for profit. And I want to know, and I know you're at the national level, and this can be handled at all levels, including the national level. And if you go on to, just to see the extent of the problem, anybody out there, go on to Facebook and just search for anything that has to do with child selling, illegal adoptions, parental alienation, so on. I want to know what you, and you may not have any plan because you may not have ever heard of it before, but what you are going to do to end this problem, because it's affecting thousands and thousands and thousands of people across the nation. And like I said, I want to remain on the line for your answer so that I have 5 seconds to give a rebuttal.
All right, David, let's give the representative a chance to respond to your question, and we will keep you on the line.
Thank you.
Thanks, David. I don't know enough about your particular case to be able to say that I know what the appellate court said or what the lawsuit alleged, and so I apologize for that. But I appreciate that you've got the courage to talk about your personal circumstances. I am aware that there was a recent journal article about allegations about even our own Children, Youth, and Families Department about sort of inside adoption opportunities that I thought were very troubling in the context of those allegations. And from someone in government who, as an insider in government, had trouble getting even the inside or the outside to recognize that we had a pattern of abuse and a problem in state government in holding perpetrators accountable, which is why in the 90s, I went undercover in a long-term care facility. I would tell you that my personal experience is that those allegations, for some, can be accurate, and that we've got a responsibility to do something. Now, I just don't know whether they are accurate here, and I don't know what your lawsuit said. Human trafficking, whether that's being a private issue where the public sector is participating in, is either way, it is untenable. It should absolutely be illegal, and we should be taking every federal and state step to eradicate those efforts. And so I'm interested in your rebuttal, so I have a sense about what you think ought to occur.
All right, David, thank you. And wait, quickly, please, because we have other people waiting on the line. Thank you.
In 5 seconds, please write this down, 505-331-2647, 331-2647, and just contact me, and I will fully inform you, and you can see that there are thousands of people like myself. And remember the key thing, I won at the Court of Appeals, which proves that I currently am factually correct as to what I say, and children are being illegally adopted, so say Kennedy, Bustamante, and Wexler. 331-2647. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Thanks for your call, David. We're speaking with First District Representative Michelle Lujan Grisham. She is the first Latina to serve as a representative of New Mexico. There's a lot of firsts in your family. I was reading that your grandfather was the first Hispanic Supreme Court Justice in New Mexico. You were the first Secretary of the Aging and Long-Term Services Department when that department was elevated to a cabinet-level position. I just want to ask you a little bit about how that feels. I mean, it's this history of firsts.
You know, I didn't really think about it until after I was elected, and I had this this moment, Elaine, on election night where I was talking to this incredibly powerful, you know, a group of individuals who worked hard for this election and want something different in Washington. I was so honored and so excited, and I got choked up. Because my father wasn't there. He really put a bug in my ear to run in 2008. He worked on my campaign. He was very excited when I got elected to the Bernalillo County Commission. And then, you know, I was really, I had to really think about whether I was going to run for this seat again. Because it's, you got to know that you have the fire in your belly, that you've got the opportunity to make a difference, that you're doing it for the right reasons. And it is a huge sacrifice, which I'm honored to be able to do to your family. And now I'm the primary caregiver for my mom because I've lost my father, and whether I could really do all of that. And on his deathbed, he said, "You can do it. I want you to do it. I think you can really make a difference. I believe in you." And he gave me my first campaign donation, you know, to launch in that 2012 election campaign. My family loved New Mexico. And they also had hard, you know, fought battles that they won. My sister was significantly disabled, and my mom was her best champion. And my dad started the public health dental programs and also the dental hygienist program. And so I think that when you love where you are and your community, it becomes very easy to find yourself in a public service environment. And I'm just so lucky to have been raised in an environment where I'm able to give and so much is returned to me. And so I'm very proud to be in that first seat, and I hope to make everybody who I represent proud of the work that I do.
Let's take another call. Colleen in Albuquerque. Good morning, Colleen. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I was just wondering about the gun issue. I know I'm supportive of the bill that's going through, but I did see a video online yesterday. There's a guy who's actually designing guns that can be printed, and so you wouldn't have to go through any kind of registration process. You could just print the parts of your gun in a 3D printer and then assemble your gun, or you could order parts of the gun and then assemble it. And so you could have the same weapon that the guy who killed all those children at Sandy, you could actually create that gun literally by printing it. And he had a really interesting point. His point was that whatever legislation went through, that still wouldn't prevent people who wanted to kill people from killing people, and also that, you know, I just thought it was interesting. So I wanted to know what you thought about that.
I really appreciate that point. And what you've done, and I'm going to be the devil's advocate here, is really in a very succinct and effective way identified how this debate is going to go in Washington and is going in states all across the country, that you can never legislate someone's individual safety at 100%. It's impossible. We can do any multitude of restrictions and proactive sort of public health investments and more mental health support. And at the end of the day, if somebody has an issue and is troubled, whatever actions they're going to take, we're not going to have thought of them, and they're going to do everything in their power to execute. And that's exactly why they're saying you're going to over-legislate this problem, and then all you're going to do is restrict a law-abiding, responsible gun owner's ability to do that, and it's not fair. So here's what I say to that, and it is there is a lot of talk about these 3D printers that now provide you the opportunity, just like online, you can go online and find out how to do all sorts of nefarious activity that none of us need to know how to do unless we're in the special forces, and that is, we still have a responsibility to create a culture shift so that we're knowledgeable, we're aware, people get mental health support earlier rather than later, that we get that there's a diagnosis we don't have this stigma attached, so that people get the support that they need.
Well, and systems to provide that support,
right? So here's what I say to that. No, I can't prevent everything. Nobody can. But we ought to be shifting how we treat these issues in this country. And I don't ever want to have to say to a parent of a six-year-old that we didn't do everything in our power to make a difference, to shift this culture in this country. But I appreciate that point, and you are correct. No legislation will be 100% effective and stop every issue. That will be impossible. That's accurate.
Let's go to Christine in Albuquerque. Good morning, Christine. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call, and thank you, Representative Luann Grisham, for serving us. I'm calling about a bill that's been introduced into the House of Representatives by Gus Bilirosky. Raucus? Anyway, it has to do with space aid travel for 100% disabled veterans, and currently they're not eligible to travel space aid a military aircraft. And we have this bill. I'm with the National Federation of the Blind of New Mexico. I'm the first vice president and the legislative coordinator. Anyway, we were in your office in February talking about the bill, and I've also followed it up with an email. And what I'm asking is for you to sign on as a co-sponsor. So,
well,
go ahead.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for visiting us in Washington and for your service with the Federation of the Blind. I really appreciate that. We've actually been spending a lot of time with veterans advocacy organizations, so thank you. And I am getting ready to ask the Oversight and Reform Committee, which I'm a member, to do a hearing on veterans issues, because we've got an incredible backlog. I'm concerned about those benefits and protections. There is, if we don't have enough time on the show to talk about all the holes for veterans and their families. And so I will take a look at this bill sooner than we have. I apologize for that. And it is likely that we would ask to be a co-sponsor, because I'm certainly wanting to be in a leadership position to make sure that all the right benefits are being provided and the right respect for our men and women who are serving this country. And thank you for reminding me that you've asked us to do that. I really appreciate that. And again, I really appreciate your service.
On another legislation question, an email from Bob. He asks, please explain why you voted against the back-to-work budget of the Congressional Progressive Caucus.
Bob, thank you. A couple of reasons. I voted for the Van Hollen budget, which was the fix to the sequester and a balanced approach, which I believe in, that gets the economy moving but continues to deal with deficits. Some of the tax hikes in the progressive budget for a state that's as poor as New Mexico and for the middle class that I think are really still fragile here, I thought it went too far to raise taxes on middle class families, and so I voted against it. I also voted against a similar budget that was produced by the Black Caucus or African American Caucus of the House of Representatives, and those were the reasons. The budgets that really refocused and shifted our investments in many of the social safety nets, I was excited about the priorities in both those budgets. So I can tell you that the Progressive Caucus and I worked together quite well, and Keith Ellison, one of those members, and Alan Grace and Mark DeConnell, there's some great members who were very, very effective at figuring out ways to really get out there and make sure that we protect Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security and those social safety net, and a multitude of other things like public education. But it just didn't protect the middle class, I thought, enough. And I'm worried about the status in New Mexico. So take a look at the Van Hollen budget. I'll also get it on our website. But I thought it was a much more balanced approach, and it also withdrew the sequester.
You can call 277-5866 if you have a quick question here as we come up to the end of the show, our discussion with First District Representative Michelle Lujan Grisham. I want to ask you about a proposal that the Department of Energy is expected to present to the New Mexico Environment Department to ship some nuclear waste from some tanks at the Hanford Nuclear Reservation in Washington State to the waste isolation pilot plant in Carlsbad, New Mexico. Have you heard about this draft proposal? What are your initial reactions?
I have, and I don't have, again, all of the facts. That's the most exciting thing about being a member of Congress. I feel like I'm going to college every day. It's fantastic, and get to learn in depth these issues. And what listeners may not know, that during college and right out of college, I worked on uranium tailings research, and then actually worked for Westinghouse Advanced Energy Systems Division while they were mining WIP. And we got to work with the team. I was the administrative assistant, to put this in perspective, those health scientists and physicists who were working on those TruPack containers. And they were quite excited about the long – I'm actually going to get someplace with this.
The TruPack containers are the containers that are used to ship the waste.
That's right, that low-level radioactive waste. Right? And when they designed those, my recollection is that the design of those would also allow them to do higher-level transportation and storage, if that was something that would still safe today and something that, say, New Mexico thought
would
be
appropriate. So you would potentially support that?
It depends. Here's the issue. We got to put it somewhere, and I want it to be safe. I want us to be thinking about better ways to provide cost-effective power to this country. I'll tell you that for sure. We have not been a very balanced nation about figuring out what the environmental safeguards are as we try to figure out what the next steps are. I know that Eddy County believes that not only is this viable, a very good business application for WIP and preserves their economic development in that community. I think they're right on in terms of bringing a proposal. Here's what I want. What is in the proposal? And what are the environmental standards for both transportation? And I want to point out they've never had an accident. I need
I
to know
there's been
more.
An accident, but no spill.
That's what you're right. An accident, but no spill. They have, we haven't had any emergency disaster response as a result. So that that makes me proud of the work that we did way back when. But I need to know more about what's really being proposed and what standards we would have to put in place to make sure that New Mexicans are protected.
We have Cliff on the line in Albuquerque with a question about this particular issue.
Hey,
you're
Cliff.
You're on the air, Cliff.
Oh, hello, Elaine. Hello, Mrs. Grisham. Yes, I'm a student at UNM, a grad student, and about this nuclear waste, I wanted to mention that, you know, the fact that putting it in Carlsbad, I just think that, you know, Carlsbad is a beautiful place and the caverns and everything else. I just think the location, you know, it should be where there's less commerce or as distant as possible. I think we should probably put it near the border. You know, I mean, honestly, you know, it has to be placed someplace, you know, and I don't want it to be detrimental to us, you know, that are living in the state, you know. So what's your opinion about that?
Well, Cliff, you've raised the thanks, Elaine. Our listeners are fantastic.
Part of the reason I bring it up is I've done some reporting on this story. We'll be airing a feature piece that I did with some interviews of some people in New Mexico about this issue this evening. And we aired a story from Hanford, from Washington State this morning, produced by a reporter up in Washington State. So it's an issue that we're following here at KUNM. Your response to Cliff's suggestion, move it as far away, as close to the border as possible?
Well, you still have the same issues, right? You still have human capital. We got to make sure that we're protecting everybody. We have a responsibility to do that.
Even
still
people on the other side of the border, is that what you're saying?
You betcha. We have a responsibility to protect everyone. This is our waste, and just the notion about, and I think that that's exactly the issue. So here's Cliff's issue. Everyone in this debate who's concerned about the environmental hazards, and for the right reasons, wants it to be far away from them. So then exactly who loses in that design from that perspective? I want winners in this design. I want to protect people from the environmental hazards. I want to know where it is, what it is. I want to know how it's monitored. I want to know why, where, when. And then I want us to be doing research for long-term solutions that are not just about storage, but long-term safety. And Sandia Labs would be a great place to make sure that that research gets conducted and completed.
I want to know what your next first is going to be.
Okay.
What's your next first? What's the next thing you're going to do for the first time?
You know what? I'm going to be the first member of Congress to get people to talk about caregiving in a way that's about economic security for women and not about women's responsibility to provide care to others.
Thank you. Michelle Lujan Grisham represents the 1st District here in New Mexico and Washington, D.C. She was elected in 2012. She is a Democrat. If you missed part of this show, you will be able to find it online shortly. And thank you so much for your time. Thank you all for your calls. Marshall Broyles engineered this morning. Andy Lyman produced, and Michael Hess took your calls. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back next week at 8 o'clock with a special edition for our pledge drive. I'm Elaine Baumgartel. This is KUNM.